Welcome to The Art Scene, presented each week by UALR's College of Arts, Humanities and Social Sciences and UALR Public Radio. Anyone who has taken part in any or all of the 10 Arkansas Literary Festivals cannot help but feel the excitement and energy generated by the presence of so many people, writers in every possible genre, readers, of course, and book lovers in general. Each year, an extraordinary variety of the above gather in downtown Little Rock, and 2013 was no exception. Amongst those authors featured this year in the wealth of sessions where we all could sit and listen to our heart's content was Eric Rutko, my guest today, the author of American Canopy, Trees, Forests, and the Making of a Nation. He grew up with a love for trees, which became a passion to discover more about them. So how did this lead him to write this extraordinary book?
I, like sort of pretty much anyone in America, grew up in a landscape that had trees. I grew up in the suburbs, which is one of the least interesting tree landscapes around. So what initially got me interested in trees was I started with tree identification. I really wanted to know what the names were of the trees around me, partly so I would feel comfortable in the woods and partly just out of curiosity. There's that very human quality that until you can name something, you don't really feel like you have a strong connection to it. From that, I just started thinking increasingly historically. Partly it was because I'd been spending a lot of time outside of the United States, and I'd been using trees as a way to get to know other cultures. And at some point, a light went off, and I realized that I might be able to do the same thing, but to start asking questions about American culture. I had assumed that there would be a number of books that sort of addressed what I was doing, which was essentially to retell American history through the perspective of trees. But there's very little. There's a few things that are sort of strictly forest histories, but nothing that really attempts to reinterpret the American experience through trees. So from there, I sort of let my own curiosity drive the research, and I just kept being sort of blown away at how big the story kept on getting and how much more there was than I had even imagined there would be at the start.
Now, would this book have been possible for the details that you found and written in without the internet and computers?
Certainly wouldn't shortchange this sort of old-fashioned, just sort of digging through people's, original writings and digging through government reports and sort of scraping this stuff together. So certainly a hybrid. The internet helps, the tool that I'm a big fan of, but as someone who does a lot of teaching of undergrads these days, I think that seeing it as the solution to research and as an end in itself is very dangerous, personally.
To introduce the book with the death of Prometheus, what a sad story. Did the repercussions of cutting down that incredible tree make a major negative impact on the poor chap, Donald Curry?
It left the lesson. For the rest of his life, he was stuck having to answer questions about it, and he was still giving interviews up until his death. I think that he probably fell on the side of believing that it was a fortunate mistake, but an understandable one given scientific procedures. And it is just an unbelievable tragedy. I mean, I think, first of all, very few Americans would know that the oldest trees in the world, and for that matter, the oldest living objects in the world, are located in the United States. And then, secondly, that we cut the oldest one down, and we still have not found an older tree. That, you know, it's now been almost 50 years, and we're still searching. You know, it's just remarkable. 1964, and here we go, cutting down a tree that was almost 5,000 years old.
Well, have you ever heard of the Fortingall Yew?
That's in Scotland, right?
Yes, and it's supposed to have been there when Pontius Pilate was born, because he was supposed, myth has, that he was born in Scotland because it was occupied by Rome at that point. And since then, they've been doing more and more research on it and the number of trunks that have been cut off in the surrounds of the old tree itself that's still very healthy. And they're tracing it back to 4,000-5,000 years and maybe even older.
When it comes to sort of what exactly is the oldest tree and the oldest living object on Earth, it starts to become fairly controversial. If you're talking about root systems, then there probably are some tree root systems that are older, and I would put the yew tree in that category.
Mm-hmm.
with Rislicone time, you can actually count the rings going back 5,000 years.
Yeah, amazing.
So it's sort of one continuous system that way.
The early chapters, when you're going back to the early settlements, I had no idea until you described them in such detail that there were these huge trees in the eastern seaboard, in the eastern states, where they've all been cut down for various reasons, but most specifically at the point when ships needed tall masts that were straight. And you mentioned that England had pretty much denuded the Scandinavian countries from any pines that were adequately tall enough and strong enough.
The Scandinavian pines were not going to get totally wiped out. What it really came down to was that the white pines, the same white pines that we still have in the East, but ones that were older than anything you really see now, were in many ways considered structurally superior for masts than anything you could find in Europe. Partly because they were larger, and partly just because of the quality of the wood itself, its flexibility and its weight. And so, since England had colonial control of its outpost here, it didn't have to worry about duties and shipping taxes, and these trees were considered superior. And so there was a shift over time where the British began to favor for mass the white pines of New England. And you really, there's very few examples. There's one stand in northwest Connecticut called the Cathedral Pines that I've been to where you can actually see what an old-growth pine looks like and just how large these pine trees get. And it's really quite remarkable because a tree that old, the bark looks different than a younger tree, the shape of it begins to look different, and there are these just spectacular specimens, but there's practically none of them left.
Yeah. But when you describe the size of them and what the weight and the sheer overwhelming task to cut down one, let alone enough to ship to fulfill the demands coming from England, that, I mean, you bring mythology into the death of Prometheus, but it was a Herculean task that they set themselves.
Well, it certainly is. I would say that felling the great white pines for mass, and these are trees that could be well over 200 feet tall in certain cases, was probably just about the single most imposing task when it came to facing up to nature that the early colonists had to deal with. When these would come crashing to the ground, they could kill people. The path of getting these to a river, you could only really do this in wintertime because you needed to be able to move them over ice trails because there's just no way to drag a tree that large and heavy using oxen power in the warm months. You could never do it. So first, just to get it to the river was this remarkable voyage. And then to see these massive trees floating on the river was such a sight that crowds would actually gather at certain points along the river just to watch these logs float past. It was that big a phenomenon in the time. Mm. And it's really hard for us to imagine now. I mean, the trees out west grow even larger, so it's not as though no trees in the world equal these size. They certainly do. But nowadays, we live in a mechanized age. It's hard to put yourself in the shoes of what would have been the early European settlers in the U.S.
I know. Have you, now this is all basically the 17th century when this massive felling of these massive trees. Have you read any of the novels of Philippa Gregory?
I know her name and I sort of am aware of her stuff, but I haven't.
How does the name Tradescant ring any bells with you?
No, but tell me what that is. Now you've piqued my curiosity.
Well, there was a gardener, Tradescant, for a Cornish name. Anything that begins with a T-R-E is considered Cornish.
Is that right? Okay.
He was they have a little poem. By the tree, the poll and pen, ye shall know the Cornish men. And if you...
Okay. That's fascinating.
Anyway, he was chief gardener for Cecil, Lord Cecil, who was Queen Elizabeth's éminence grise. And he had a passion for collecting things. And he sent Tradescant all around the world, primarily to pick up things like the chestnut, which he brought to England, had never been before. The tulip had never been seen before he brought them to England. And he and his son and his grandson were all master gardeners, we'd call them now. They had the beginning of true, you know, the wonderful gardens in England owe a debt to this particular family. And his grandson it was who went to the United States and just became totally enthralled by what he discovered and brought home shiploads of new things he'd found in the New World. And I wondered if you had found that name in your search through all these early days of the United States, or they weren't United then, but America anyway.
I don't remember seeing that name, but certainly the older works are filled with these British gardeners and people that would then soon start considering themselves as botanists.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the gardening tradition in England was as developed as anywhere, you know, maybe Japan and England at this point would probably have had the most advanced tradition.
Mm-hmm.
And England was obsessed with collecting all sorts of plants from across the world and across its colonies, and trees, because, you know, tropical trees are not going to thrive in England unless you're growing them under greenhouse conditions. It's very difficult to do that. Whereas the American trees, certainly from the temperate parts of the East Coast, did quite well in England.
Mm-hmm.
And so a very, very active trade quickly developed. And in the 1700s, there were just large numbers of trees, certainly by the middle of the 1700s, coming from America to England, because for all the aristocracy, having gardens filled with American trees was actually sort of a sign of status at that point.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that surprised me was there, I forget who it was, but one of the British lords was said to have actually died from, I think, a pleurisy that he contracted because he was out in the cold for too long watching them plant American trees on his property.
Yeah, that was the Prince of Wales, I think you said in your book. The book is full of little sidelines that are just such fun to read. What you say about Washington and the cherry tree, that never for a man of his passionate love for trees would he ever have been guilty of cutting down a tree.
It's one of the ultimate ironies. You could not pick a less appropriate story to make up about the guy. It's just terrible to me that that's how we all think of George Washington.
I know, but what the character you draw, he is remarkable, that the pull of the land and of nature that must have been instilled in him early, because wasn't he a surveyor of some kind?
He was a surveyor. He knew the land exceptionally well around Virginia, and he knew the tree species. I mean, he could walk and name every species he would see along the landscape. And when he was a general, he would be traveling along, and that's the sort of sensibility that he took with him. He had a surveyor's eye for the land that went back to his teenage years, really.
Yeah. But this description of him and the letters he wrote about which trees more he were coming and where they were growing, mm-hmm. I don't think there was ever another president with that appreciation of natural growth and using the things that belonged. You know, you think of Jefferson and his amazing ability to create Monticello and his eye for proportion and grace, but he was forcing onto the landscape another landscape that was brought in from the Greeks and Romans and the French and the traditions that make it a marvelous thing to see, but didn't have that love, adoration that Washington seems to have brought to the same kind of eye for improving his property.
To a certain extent, I think that's right. Jefferson had this just restless curiosity. And he was a polymath, and his view of a lot of these plants was he wanted to experiment, and he was interested in many of them for what we would think of more sort of utilitarian purposes. He really was just interested in what would produce sort of the most delicious fruit, the most productive vegetables, all sorts of things along those lines. And he was definitely interested in landscape gardening in a certain respect, but Washington sort of had more of a connection to the British aristocratic tradition of using trees to turn the landscape into this pastoral oasis. And in my view, Washington was more of a pure tree guy than Jefferson was.
Mm-hmm.
Jefferson was sort of an eclectic horticulturalist. He has a garden. He had one of the most, probably by most measures, the most remarkable garden in all of the North American colonies during his lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
But Washington was just fascinated by tree planting. oversaw huge numbers of trees being planted on his estate and was frequently thinking about it, enjoyed going out there and planting trees. So he did have this mindset. But I would sort of take issue, which is to say that when it comes down to it, if I had to rank the presidents as sort of tree lovers, for lack of a better term, Franklin Roosevelt might be the one that I would rank number one.
Oh, really?
I think so, yeah. I mean, what I'm saying about Washington is all true, and you can glean it from his writings. Of course, Washington didn't leave us extensive writings, and certainly we don't get sort of a full autobiography or anything. And we don't have that with FDR, but what we do have, one of my favorite, and this is in the book, and it's just always, sometimes when I'm giving talks, I tell audiences this, and they're always amazed, is that when Franklin Roosevelt goes to the voting booth, he lists himself as his profession, he lists as tree grower. 1944, goes to the voting booth in Hyde Park, and he writes his profession down as tree grower. I'm quite certain that's the only time that's ever happened in U.S. history.
Yeah.
And this was not meant as sort of some ironic statement or anything. I mean, you would think it would be, considering this is the midst of World War II. But Roosevelt planted over 500,000 trees on his family's estate.
I know he was the one who, you have it, the shelter belt, when he wanted...
The shelter belt, yes.
In that dreadful...
The trees that Roosevelt had was endless of what trees could be.
Yes. But did you have the same sort of feeling of surprise and delight when you found this out, or did you know it already before you started researching?
Oh, I was blown away. I mean, you know, I knew, at the outset, I was sort of aware of, when I thought of sort of Roosevelt's relationship to trees, I had sort of thought about the Civilian Conservation Corps. But I didn't appreciate until I started doing the research that if you really want to trace the evolution of Franklin Roosevelt, it's not necessarily coming out of some sort of diffuse sensibility about conservation the way you might think about environmentalism today. It really came out of an interest in forestry and came out of an awareness of tree planting that he developed on his own estate. And that would form the core of what would become the Civilian Conservation Corps, and then subsequently the Shelter Belt Plan, which in its initial inception was to plant a forest, possibly a forest that could be maybe even 100 miles wide that would run from the Canadian border down to Texas. He imagined trying to put some sort of a forest across the Great Plains as a way to remediate the Dust Bowl.
Exactly.
And like I said, he considered himself a tree farmer. When World War II broke out, he actually sold trees from his own property to support the war effort.
My guest is Eric Rutko, author of American Canopy. We'll be back after a short arts update. Just to remind listeners to check local listings and also visit our online calendar at ualrpublicradio.org. In Little Rock, Weekend Theatre opens a new show July the 12th, Monty Python's Spamalot, through the 28th, Fridays and Saturdays at 7:30, 2:30 Sunday. At the Arkansas Arts Center, see The Treasures of Kenwood House. In Eureka Springs, opera in the Ozarks is in full swing. Today at 4 p.m., a performance of The Elixir of Love in the Arend Arts Center in Bentonville. Tomorrow, The Pirates of Penzance. Tuesday, Madama Butterfly. Both at 7:30 p.m. in the Pavilion at Inspiration Point. And the three productions continue in repertory through July the 19th. And now back to American Canopy and my conversation with its author, Eric Rutko. There's so much in this book that people can find. You can read it. As you can tell, I haven't been able to read every page word by word, but get the gist of it.
It is a long book,
yes,
but I like to think it can hold your attention till the end.
Yes, and I was thinking those lovely little illustrations you have at the head of every chapter. Did you have those designed for you? Did you find them somewhere, or did you draw them yourself?
I'm glad you asked. I'm very fond of those illustrations, and they're historically very important, actually. So I had been talking to my publisher, and my publisher had been interested in including illustrations with the book. And so we were thinking about different ways to go about that. And we had had some different types of ideas. We had mock-ups that we were looking at. But when I looked at them, I really wasn't satisfied with anything that we had seen in the early rounds. And I started thinking about what would sort of capture the essence of what we were doing. And it occurred to me that one of the books that I just thought was so interesting was the first illustrated book of North American trees, which was published in 1817 by François-André Michaud, who's a relatively minor figure in the book. His father features prominently in the book. His father was a botanist to the French court who was stationed in America to collect trees and other plants to send back to France. But the son became a full-time botanist and spent much of his life in America and published a book called North American Sylva. It was the first comprehensive illustrated book of North American trees. And we use that, we use the original plates from that are what you see at the start of each chapter.
Well, I have so many questions about those, but there are two or three particular ones. First of all, the blight that destroyed the American chestnut. Mm-hmm. I hadn't realized there was something pest-driven so early. And the chestnut tree or fronds, the leaf, the illustration, is nothing like what I've always looked on as the five-point leaf that is so distinctive of the chestnut tree in England that is also in the Buckeye here. Mm-hmm. And so, I wondered what the difference was of the American chestnut versus the chestnut from other places because, you know, as I said, England had imported the chestnut in the 16th century where it had not been in that part of Europe before.
Right. So this is actually one of the challenges with trees is that the common names of trees can often throw you down the wrong path. And I, in the book, I decided to use primarily common names, names that would be understood to the people at the time, and names that would be similar for sort of current readers. And I tried to make it clear where it can be confusing, because you know there are a few examples where it's very confusing. And one of them deals with chestnut. So what's known as a palmate compound leaf, a leaf that has sort of five different leaflets on it in sort of a star pattern, is part of the horse chestnut, is what we would call it here.
Yeah, and that's what they're called in England.
In England, you call them conkers, if I remember correctly.
Well, that's the fruit. Right? That's the fruit. They do call it a horse chestnut, but it's the fruit of the horse chestnut that's the conker. And now they won't let them play conkers because they hurt each other, and then they get sued.
Schoolboys are all getting black eyes and stuff from this. It's just the common name that it shares. It's actually not all that closely related to the American chestnut.
Okay.
And so there's a few ways that this is different. For one thing, the fruit of the horse chestnut, the conker, is it's not edible, whereas the American chestnut, the fruit, is a chestnut, which, although basically no one in the modern day has ever eaten an American chestnut, because nearly all of them have been wiped out, certainly across the East Coast, that was one of the most prized nuts that you could get anywhere in the United States.
And in the illustration for the horse chestnut in your book, there are some small chestnut nuts.
So the illustration there is of the American chestnut. And so that's an illustration that goes back to the early 19th century. The horse chestnut illustration would look somewhat different.
And then the other things, of course, that you mentioned are the pests that are attacking these wonderful trees and how England no longer has elm trees, tall and stately and ancient. But did you know that if you've been to Spain, to the Alhambra, there is an avenue of elm trees that were given to Spain by the Duke of Wellington? They are English elm trees. The only ones left are in Spain, which I learned from my son-in-law. They live in Spain, and he told me this, and I thought it was absolutely fascinating. Wellington was so impressed by the courage of the Spanish during the Peninsular Wars and sent them a present, a gift of saplings.
Well, fortunately, as deadly as the Dutch elm disease has been, and it's been very deadly, it's not quite as deadly as chestnut blight. So you are more likely to be able to find a few stands, if they've been well maintained, of elms, English elms and American elms, than you are to find stands of chestnuts, which is effectively unheard of. We also didn't really plant chestnuts as city trees, partly because the fruits made so many spiky husks. But in America, you can still find a very beautiful stand of American elms in Central Park, along what's known as Literary Walk. And as far as I know, it is the largest stand of American elms in the East. And they were planted after World War I, originally as memorials to soldiers who had died during the war.
And they haven't been affected by any disease so far.
You can treat elms, and you can if they're well maintained, you can delay the effects.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're well isolated from us, because the Dutch elm disease is spread by a bug, and the range of that bug is, relatively speaking, limited. Unlike chestnut blight, which is spread directly by fungal spores which get released into the air, and so consequently, the range of the chestnut blight can spread much more quickly and much more sort of uniformly across the landscape.
Yes, unfortunately. And the coffee growers in Mexico at the moment are fighting a fungus that's spreading and killing all their coffee bushes.
Indeed, that we're in a constant battle like this, and what's really changed, that the two things that have really sped this up in the last 150 years are the process of globalization and monocropping.
And also politics, because I was just thinking towards the end of your book, when you're into the modern era and what's happening, that one president can decree, like Clinton did, to save millions of acres of virgin forest in the West, and then subsequent presidents can, with a wipe of the pen, discontinue it.
Well, I certainly hope it comes across that this is always a political story. Trees and power are never too far apart. One of my favorite stories is actually in the late 19th century, the government was effectively shut down briefly because I believe it was Cleveland refused to sign the omnibus budget bill. He pocket vetoed it because it contained provisions dealing with forests that he was unsatisfied with. And so temporarily, things were effectively grinded to a halt. And of course, under Teddy Roosevelt, he put the care of the forest, the creation of national forests, at the top of his agenda. If you read his speeches to Congress, it's all over, which is partly because those speeches were in large part written by Gifford Pinchot, who was the founder of the Forest Service and one of Teddy Roosevelt's closest confidants. So trees and politics are never that far apart.
No, it would seem so. And you end the book, those last two paragraphs in your book, read them,
sure,
because you say some very poignant things.
No problem. Yeah, I can do that. As we rush headlong into the 21st century, the physicality of trees seems more vital than ever. The modern workplace and home are becoming increasingly antiseptic. Americans now spend their days staring into computer screens that receive information as if by magic. Daily life seems alarmingly virtual. Trees provide the antidote. The smell of pine needles, the crunch of autumn leaves, the roughness of bark are all reminders that we are a part of nature. Tree hugging, in its most literal sense, offers a reconnection with the physical world, the world of our forefathers. The forest and their trees are a sanctuary for the spirit. To enter them is to seek renewal. Rarely do these trees receive the public attention that they deserve. Gone are the fears of a timber famine that might destroy the economy. Our success in preserving our forests from total destruction has made it easy to overlook them altogether. Trees appear frozen in time, and the invisibility of gradual change can make problems difficult to spot. The nation tends to rediscover its tree resources only in periods of catastrophe. The rest of the time, many of us motor along with indifference, leaving the issue to the government, corporations, and the permanent environmental movement. But this is a risky approach. America's forests and trees are more necessary now than ever.
That was Eric Rutko, author of American Canopy, Trees, Forests, and the Making of a Nation, published by Scribner, now out in paperback. Winner of the 2012 U.S. History American Publishers Award, praised as an original and often surprising take on American history, and a beautifully written, devilishly original piece of work. This conversation was taped just before he came to the 10th Annual Arkansas Literary Festival in April of this year as a featured speaker. I hope some of you were at his session or had a chance to meet him at the author party. Next year, Arkansas Literary Festival 2014 is set for April 24th through 27th. Mark your calendars now. And that concludes this week's program. Please join us next weekend at the same time. I'm Ann Nicholson. Thank you for listening.
The Art Scene is a presentation of UALR's College of Arts, Humanities, and Social Sciences and UALR Public Radio.